Good night, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome again to another edition of State of Our Nation. Now, we had the response, an analysis of the budget yesterday, and today, as the opposition leader speaks, we are attempting to unpack some of what he is saying in opposition to the budget. Purely from an economic standpoint, again, we have our special guest, Professor Troy Lord from the University of the West Indies, Dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences. And again, we really do appreciate his presence here with us to help us unpack this again from a purely economic standpoint. Now, Professor, again, good night and welcome.
Good night.
Obviously, there's a lot to unpack. We are doing it during the break that Parliament has taken at this point. And obviously, we don't want to tread into the political waters of some of the things that the opposition leader has brought to bear. But from your economic standpoint, some of his analysis of what was said in the budget, I mean, how does it hold water? How does it stack up? I mean, we had a talk of the foreign laborers being employed, and how that can impact, if that is indeed true, what deleterious impact that could have on the economy, or would the hotels being constructed, the six hotels being constructed, in the aftermath of the construction phase, what type of economic boom or economic impact would that have on the country? And then I think something I wanted to pay particular interest to as it relates to his suggestion that inflation has accounted significantly for growth has factored into the calculation, and therefore real growth, but rather inflationary growth. I want to break that down for our listeners, and also explain to us if you believe that argument does indeed hold water. So you can dive in at any point.
Right. Okay, good. So you'll help me to go through the number of things that you raised. So what I will do, I will speak about the one that caught my attention first, which was the one relating to the building of six hotels. And good night to listeners. So the construction of six hotels would have impacts both in the short term and the long term. So naturally, in the short term, there's going to be job creation and construction, increased economic activity. And I mean, one of the things you find in the Barbados economy certainly is that when there's a construction boom, you find that, you know, the country tends to do well. It's kind of a bellwether, to be quite honest, because of the way that the money is spent. The types of worker that, you know, is employed by the construction sector, they spend money and that money turns over, right? So you generally get what I would say is a spike in economic activity and a kind of an overall boom to the economy. Consistent though with that spend though, is you can also have some short-term inflationary pressures, because typically as well, a lot of the materials that are used for construction, they're imported, right? And so, you know, this will tend to raise prices as well in terms of construction by, you know, persons building houses for residential purposes, and naturally, you know, those that are in commercial buildings being built for commercial purposes. So it could be a short-term spike in inflation. You may also see, depending upon the tightness in the economy, tightness in the labor market, it is possible as well, if it's a tight labor market, you can also see potential wage inflation as more workers into the market and have to be hired to work in the sector. And I've heard just anecdotally that is the case. I suppose then if I switch now to a kind of a long-term impact, I mean, one would expect, yes, you could see with newer hotels, at least these sound like these are buildings, of course, in the traditional accommodation sector when we speak hotels. I'm not aware of the how they will be constructed in terms of the layout and the touches and so forth. But if these are at the higher end, then of course you would expect to then see higher prices, and possibly you could attract perhaps that sort of high-end tourists as well, as long as there's good occupancy during the tourist season and reasonably high occupancy in the slow or the low season. Then yeah, you expect job opportunities in housekeeping, front desk management, security, entertainment, and so forth. We've always had a challenge in the sector, really, though, of persons being able to secure really the higher paying jobs in the sector. But I would say at least these types of opportunities arise, and the linkages to agriculture are there. They could be way better. I would say that I've never really been satisfied of the linkage between tourism and agriculture. But you can see definitely that there could be an increased demand for local food products that could benefit farmers and so forth. The possible negative impacts of that, though, I mentioned, you know, because our tourism is very highly seasonal, I mean, you know, they could struggle with low occupancy rates in the low season. And by extension, jobs would also be highly seasonal. So, you know, you have that situation where there's precarity by workers in tourism. Naturally, tourism, by the way it's designed, there's a lot of foreign exchange leakage. And it's unclear, even though these hotels are being built, you know, the ownership, I'm not aware of them, but, you know, they have the potential. The revenue and the investment could contribute in several ways. The revenue, the taxes, the VAT, corporate tax, employee pay-as-you-go, more NAS contributions from new hotel employees, you know, the spillovers in terms of car rental, the event planning, entertainment, and so forth. We have, though, to be cognizant of the environment we're in. You know, we're seeing increasing signs of volatility globally with what's happening in USA and their partners, traditional allies. And so, you know, this, because tourism is a very discretionary item, we may and are likely to see some fallout from this probably in the next tourist season if things don't stabilize. So that's the first thing that you mentioned, Carville. You asked me about inflation. I believe the question was really whether or not the numbers are, is it that the numbers we see, or is there some uncertainty about those numbers?
Well, basically he's saying that the growth numbers as projected mm-hmm, by the central bank would be somewhat skewed, because those are based on inflation.
All right, I see. Good.
I myself must admit that I am speaking strictly from a layman. I am no economist by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
To break it down to me, as well as our listeners. But I mean, from the little I know that we do get those numbers from the Statistical Service. So
right.
I am trying to figure out.
Yeah. Well, we have to. I agree. Yeah, we have to trust that the numbers reported by the Barbados Statistical Service are true. We trust them. There is an institution that's been around for a long time, and we value the work that they do. So, but I will say there have been two numbers. We tended always historically to report just the real GDP figures, because with the real GDP figures, what we do there is that we hold prices fixed, so to speak. We use a base year. And that way, then, when we calculate GDP, the numbers that we report are only based on either growth in GDP or decline in GDP. So that then we're talking about output, the production of goods and services. That value, then we're saying, because we keep the base year prices fixed, any change in GDP then would have to be brought about only by changes in output. So the numbers, though, that we've seen recorded, we've heard pretty good numbers in the last few years. From the central bank, being reported by the central bank, but just again to clarify for everyone, these are numbers that are calculated by the Barbados Statistical Service. So when we see, and I can't call the rates off the top of my head for the different years, but certainly we know that the numbers suggest, though, that we've been experiencing, positive rates of growth. And so I guess that being the case, then the issue of inflation does not come into that calculation. Those numbers aren't inflation caused growth rate, so to speak. When though they speak about nominal GDP, yes, then it's a combination of both changes in prices and generally upward, and output being combined to give the number. So that's what you hear then yesterday in the budget, that the nominal GDP was around 14 billion Barbados dollars, because that includes also changes in prices, but that real GDP was just over 10 billion Barbados dollars, because that is the figure where now we've basically controlled for the effect of inflation, and we only reporting on the value of output in real terms. Right. Continue. You have to keep reminding me of the things that you raised. There were so many.
Yeah, I know, and we are gonna unpack as we go along. But there was this other issue that I think that would benefit from your expertise, as it relates to, well, obviously our U.S. source market in tourism has grown significantly recently, and the suggestion is that this further exemplifies the need for urgent diversification, given the fact that if that is now, you know, up there with, maybe has even overtaken the UK in terms of numbers arriving, the US visitor doesn't spend as much, and therefore the spend is not going to be as significant as, let's say, the
UK right
traveler. Does that argument whole water again in what has been put forward by the opposition leader?
Right. So truthfully, it's something that a lot of us have said we should report more on when it comes to tourism. We tend to report on the arrivals, but the arrivals, which is important, we do want to see more. Well, from the tourism perspective, you want to definitely see more, because one hopes that the more tourists arrive, then the greater the aggregate spending. But what the opposition leader, Ralph Vaughan, is referring to is the average spend. And so, yes, I definitely recall, I haven't looked at them in recent times, you would definitely find the average spend by a tourist from out of the UK market was higher on average. And they also, you know, were here for a longer time compared to the tourist average time length of stay from US tourists. I will say that those tend to be things that are related to the time. It's a different in sort of the, what should I call it, the labor markets in both countries. Persons in the United States get less time off, and they also get less paid time off as well. And so if we were to compare them, yeah, you may say that they are more budget conscious type of tourists compared to those out of the UK market. Now, the thing is that, in terms of the diversification, which is where the question started. So the diversification has to happen in a number of ways. I mentioned that we're likely to see some fallout, and not just from the United States market, perhaps. So you're going to see a fallout from the Canadian market as well, because they've been directly targeted by the tariffs from the Trump administration. Not Europe yet specifically, and not the UK either, but these things are, it's hard to contain trade wars, and even if it's not the United States directly targeting UK or Europe, you'll find though that might, like, there's going to be some effect. So anyway, let's get back to the issue of diversification. So diversification has to happen in many different ways. So both, yes, in terms of the tourists, the markets, we've spoken about this for a long time, and it's not just really about, we've tried, I mean, we've looked, for example, we've spoken about, you know, tourists from Brazil. We've talked about things like tourists from China. Of course, no, more recently, tourists from out of countries in Africa. The issue is always the airlift. Once you don't have that real direct and easy airlift, that's going to be problematic. So that's one way for sure, certainly, though, that would perhaps help to mitigate any fallout from the United States market, diversification of our source markets. But it's been something that's been talked about for a long time. But then it's also diversification about the type of tourists. Now, the prices in Barbados tends to mean, though, that Barbados is marketed and considered a high-end tourist destination. I don't know necessarily that that's what we set out to be. I think that's what we have to consider ourselves as, given the price of our tourism product. It's an expensive tourism product. And so maybe just out of result of just common sense, if the prices are so high, we have to be consider ourselves high end and market ourselves that way. But there's other types of tourists that, you know, are out there. I don't know that our tourism authority, the DTMI and the Ministry of Tourism, may be necessarily directly targeting that type of tourist, a more budget conscious tourist. These persons may tend to be ones that may look to, you know, stay in an Airbnb, may shop in the local supermarkets, ride on the buses, and kind of do things like locals do, and do less things like rent a car or stay at an all-inclusive, or, you know, the ones that tend to be pricier, especially during the tourist season, they may not do that. But I'm just saying we have to also consider that diversification, the type of tourist would also be considered. Now, I'm going to go even broader with diversification, and this goes back now to the type of economy, the structure of our economy. We speak about it all the time, but we do have to definitely consider it. I'm going to say consider it, and that doesn't really properly speak to really what I'm saying. But diversification isn't only for government. Huh? Understand when I say that is that there are other sectors, other industries that we have to pay more attention to. Government can play a part here as well by honestly looking to support, you know, these other, let's call them emerging sectors that exist. Now, one of the things I'll say, Colville, and sorry for speaking so long on this matter.
No problem.
Right. So, I mean, we put a lot of money into tourism. We do. There's others. We have in Barbados, there are more small businesses than anything else, than any other type of firm. And, you know, I can't say of this exact mechanism when I speak about how they would be supported, but they have to be supported both financially, but also in terms of technical support, which is to say to help them come up to scale from, you know, basically doing things like maybe selling at farmers markets, or maybe only supplying products maybe to some local supermarkets and so forth. They're small, they tend to either manufacture their goods in their kitchens, maybe a small attachment to their houses. If they're lucky, maybe they have the size to perhaps rent a unit from one of the industrial parks. But I've had the opportunity in the past to sample some of the things that they produce. And then I've considered some of the things that I've had from abroad. And I will say that a lot of the products are high quality. And I would say worthy of export. The challenge is the financing, the challenge is the exposure, the marketing. And then even if they were exposed, I'll be honest, then the matter, it will always come down to whether they can supply. Imagine a small business basically getting exposure at a large trade show. Did they get an order from, say, an international supermarket chain like Tesco, Asda, whomever? And you'll feel happy at first, but then they say they will want, say, a 20-foot container twice a month. Well, the small business here, how are they going to get the resources to supply that, even though that'll be great? But I'm just saying, when we speak of diversification, I think a lot more energy has to be put into that really underserved, but really there's a lot of potential there, I think, for small businesses to basically eventually reach scale, to reach the point where maybe they can even export and bring in foreign exchange. So I'm just saying, though, but largely, I know I heard in the budget yesterday talk about things like artificial intelligence, work in business and data analytics. We do have master's degrees offered by KFL in that, and we do have an undergraduate degree with that concentration. So, I mean, the capacity is being built there, but then it's not only for persons to get individual skills. It has to be the case then that there is a direct and concerted effort to then harness that training into areas that can actually support the government. I mean, the skills are being produced, huh? But then, you know, there has to be the support from the entrepreneurial intent by both the existing private sector and entrepreneurial intent also by the government, really, if you want to really just see us remove our over-dependency on tourism.
Okay. Now, There is a statement. I know that I made it clear from the beginning that we are not in any way going to venture into the political weeds. There is an economic point to be had from there was an allegation of corruption within the government. And now, obviously, we know that corruption the government's perception or the view of government being corrupted has a serious link towards investor confidence.
For sure.
Now, the question goes out. I mean, we are not trying to ascertain whether his statements are true or not.
But, right.
The question is, how serious this is going out to the world? How serious are those statements as it relates as persons viewing and can they have some impact as persons who are seeking to invest in Barbados?
Not really. I don't really think there'll be any significant fallout. I would say that you tend to hear allegations of corruption oftentimes by whomever is in opposition. So I'm not just speaking, I'm not even saying it to dismiss it. I'm just saying, so in that sense, it's still an unusual thing to hear from those in opposition. But broadly, when investors, if you're speaking international investors, I mean, they will do their own due diligence. And so we have a corruptions index that is published. It's on countries worldwide. But I will hasten to add that this is not an actual measure of corruption, but it's really a measure of the perception of corruption. And so that means then that surveys will be done on different persons in different countries. I mean, the surveys are not, I would say, sufficiently representative, honestly. So it's, you know, it tends to be persons that may be in the commercial sector, you know, like business leaders and so forth, and maybe some other parties that academics would refer to as elites. I would say though that's kind of that's where they would tend to look at those types of things. But broadly speaking, investors are they're about basically securing their capital and earning a return. So they're going to be looking to see whether countries, whether there's a rule of law, you know what I mean? Whether they have recourse in terms of the courts, if there's some issue arises to either secure their property rights or if there's some sort of fallout, you know, maybe between parties, the contracts or so forth, whether they're able to go to the courts and, you know, the courts are functioning and they can have their day in court. They're going to look at the nature of the, let's say the financial system, you know, is it functioning, is it efficient, and so forth, and a number of other matters. So a specific claim about corruption isn't going to lead to any fallout. I mean, what we'd have to see is not just an allegation. We'd actually have to see that persons are brought before the courts, and there is some let's just say a verdict that suggests something was happening. And I mean, perhaps not even just a single, it wouldn't just have to be a single member if it was the case of government. It would have to suggest that the corruption was systemic, you know what I mean? And that, you know, persons are either being bribed or money is being misappropriated or laundered or something. It would literally have to rise to that level, truthfully, to start to gain, I would say, or to have a real break or shift in investor confidence.
Okay. Now, while we are trying to wrap up as quickly as possible at this point, given the fact that we want our listeners to rejoin the opposition leader as he continues his response, there is one other aspect that I think that we can still touch on. I know that full disclosure, you said that you would have been part of that committee that would have
the minimum wage board.
The opposition leader didn't explicitly state it, but he suggested that the raise, the 2% incremental raise, wouldn't really amount to much. And the suggestion would be that given the inflation and the cost of living crunch that is likely to be to come as a result of these trade wars and so on, it's not going to do much for the persons at that scale of the salary, at the salary level. Well, and now, as now that we have basically the proverbial horse's mouth right here, you have a chance to respond to that.
Well, right. So what the minister said yesterday about the 2% raise is really indicative and not actually really the work of the minimum wage board. That's not something that, without disclosing the work we are doing, that's not something that we came up with, so to speak. But in some sense, really, I suppose from the government, basically to suggest that it recognizes that there has to be some measure of adjustment on an annual basis. Certainly what we are doing, the work we are doing, is going to first of all take a look at what the rate was when the act was passed in 2021. The rate was $8.50 per hour. There was an incremental difference for those in the security sector. The exact number escapes me at the moment, but it could have been like maybe what, $9.25 roughly, or so. And so there's been no change in that. So the first thing that the board is going to look at really is to take a look at that number from 2021 and see then, at least at the minimum, what that ought to be in 2025. So once we get and we go through our analyses and we land at a number that is supported by the different stakeholders working on this this minimum wage, following that, we intend to do some work sectorally because we understand that there are differences among persons working in different sectors. But we also intend to make it easier, which is to say then that we have to find some formula for the minimum wage to adjust based on a number of factors that could include inflation, it could include productivity, it could also have a stakeholder element that, so that even though a formula is mechanistic and can just adjust up, perhaps maybe it's one we are considering maybe where there could be a qualitative element to that work. So, but I will say, yes, if I go now to the suggestion that 2% is obviously probably insufficient. I mean, if you take $8.50 and we find 2%, I mean, I did a quick calculation. I mean, not expecting this question per se, but I mean, that amounts to just 17 cents per hour. And over, let's say it was an 8-hour day. I mean, what is that? That's less than $1.70 a day. So $1.70 minus 34 cents. So about 146 cents or something like that. If I did the math right, it could be wrong. But either way, persons obviously wouldn't consider just over a dollar sufficient, obviously, a day to really, you know, have any sort of impact as far as trying to handle the cost of living that persons are experiencing. So we know we have to do some work that may recommend something that perhaps is, let's just say, probably it could be very different from what was said in the budget. But I think the way I understood what was said in the budget separately, though, is that if our work doesn't conclude, let's just say, if it were to conclude by that time, let's just say the government would, while it is waiting for our work to conclude, just go ahead and make these adjustments in the interim. But I do believe, though, that our work will conclude reasonably soon, at least at a first level, which, as I say, is more of a situation we were thinking about making an adjustment to the rate that was passed in 2021. And then once you have that almost as a baseline, then we do continue to do our work to see then what other adjustment to that number would have to be made, and really one that takes into account both the interests of labor, but also recognizes the impact that this could have on employers, and then by extension, the overall macro and microeconomic environment in Barbados.
Okay. Now, I think we are just about out of time. We are just a few seconds from the half hour mark. And as I said, we don't want our listeners to miss the rest of the opposition leaders' remarks. However, it would be remiss of me not to give you the opportunity to give your rating scale again, the economic perspective of the opposition leaders' response. Does it hold from how what type of strong economic tidbits does it hold? Give it your rating scale, and you have about a minute and a half to do it.
Right, no problem. So, I mean, I will honestly say that I thought that, you know, what he raised, Mr. Thorne, it was effective, I thought, really in addressing, highlighting key concerns that Barbadians have been raising about national debt, taxation, and public spending. And so, but his focusing on those areas, I think really what he would have done would have resonated a lot with citizens that are facing economic challenges. So I think, you know, listening to him, he focused a lot on raising debt repayments and the potential that that would then lead to underfund essential services like healthcare, infrastructure. He focused a lot on the fact that infrastructure isn't really mentioned in the budget. And I think, you know, what I would say and would be useful, I mean, even though his critique was strong, I would say, and maybe it's not his role, but I would just say, but there's a lack of detailed alternative solutions. And I guess he would say that isn't his role to give the government, and he said it, isn't his responsibility to give the government, to advise the government. But I'm saying, I would say from my perspective, it would have been great to really have seen some alternative solutions. I would say those would have strengthened the clear policy contrast between himself and the government. I would say in terms of the economic value, he did also raise valid concerns, I would say, about the sustainability. I mentioned the debt. And so his call for, I would say, consideration of existing taxes and scrutiny of government spending practices, this is all pertinent to fiscal responsibility and stability, you know? I mean, and so I think he was effective in doing these things. I would say he had there's some specific things that, of course, you know, we have to talk about. Again, the debt repayments, we can't get away from that, even though we recognize that we need to borrow to fund certain things. I think where people are concerned and the government could do a lot better job at explaining is how money is spent. So when we borrow, it would really like, I would say, a better accounting of how money has spent, where it has gone. And of course, to show then that these money spent in these places would then essentially sum back up to what was borrowed. And Mr. Thorne, I mean, when he was speaking about the monies for, the World Cup, he's spoken about this for a while, and he has concerns about the money spent, and not even if the money were spent, he has concern about the value for money. And so these are things that, you know, one would expect a responsible opposition to do, to raise. And so if I bring everything together and to give him a grade out of 5, I guess I have a number of areas where I perhaps would hearken. And so if I say effectiveness, I would give him 4 to 5. If I say for the economic value as well as what he's raised, I would say 4 to 5. If I speak though, then, and this is because, you know, I would, he's raised questions that I don't have the answers to, but questions for which I hope the government will respond to. I mean, it is definitely something that I'm looking to hear as the week progresses. I would say in terms of the truthfulness, I'm going to say the truthfulness because he's raised matters that about certain things the government has said about their truthfulness. And so by extension, by him raising those as well, it raises questions in the minds of Barbadians as well. And so if they're unanswered by the government, then we are left to infer that these questions, the things that he's raised, are perhaps, you know, what is being alluded to based on the questions that he's asked, that these things may have some grounding in truth. So I thought he did a good job. I mean, his delivery is, one that is very very stylistic, very
Shakespearean,
very dramatic. He's very oratorical, and he has a style that reminds me of a person preaching, and whatnot. But I would say the only I would say where to me he would have fallen, but I wouldn't say that as, and I mean, I guess he's saying it himself, is in terms of offering alternative solutions, even if not in any great detail, but perhaps to suggest, well, here is how they could have done it better, or maybe here's what they ought not to have done at all. So, you know, I would say four out of five, maybe there's some, you know, he's not going to really get a chance to respond, but I'd say, you know, good job. But, you know, I think that one of the things that, and this is where I land, excuse me. I would say that, and I guess it's the nature of the budget, where you have the opportunity to raise things that are not necessarily of economic or budgetary nature. Maybe I would say a lot of time spent, from my perspective, a bit too much time on that, but that's fine. I mean, it is also a political debate. And I'd say, no, if I contrast the two, the response by the opposition leader and the delivery of the budget by Minister Strawn, what I would say is that where Minister Strawn fell down again was, and as I said, I spoke about it, but it would have been the I would have liked to have seen a deeper grounding in kind of what's happening globally. A real sort of allusion to a development agenda that is clear and understood. It's there, but I think they need to do a better job at knitting it together for Barbadians to understand, so that a lot of these things don't feel as ad hoc, so to speak. And similarly, well, I've already critiqued the opposition leader. So I would say those two things are how I would contrast them. I mean, the opposition leader is a lot more oratorical, and, you know, he can speak in ways that are very, let's just say, off the cuff, and he makes a lot of references and using a lot of different law disciplines. It could be legal, it could be philosophical, it could be, you know, biblical and so forth. And that really helps him to really create a sort of delivery that is very impressive. Minister Strawn's delivery, you know, I mean, yes, he's a politician, and so you see some elements of that in his delivery too, but, you know, it's still one that is, I would say, a lot more narrow in terms of, and I mean, perhaps it's not meant to be that, but I'm just saying at least the visual is very different. And so there you go, Colville.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Lord, pleasure as always, and really, you have been so insightful, and, mm-hmm. and we again really want to thank you for indulging us and really lending your expertise, not just to us at the Nation, but the wider Barbadian public, in helping us understand mm-hmm. some of these intricate terms, both in the budget and the budget response. For again,
right.
Thank you. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in, and do have a pleasant night, and mm-hmm. do enjoy the rest of the budget response. This is Colville Munsey for Nation News, and signing out.
Good night.